KRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
As a national scandal over U.S. politicians' handling of sensitive documents continues, more classified papers are found at the former vice president's residence. Former U.S. Secretary of State says his visit to Saudi Arabia after the killing of dissident journalists was, quote, a middle finger to American media. And the Brazilian police opened an investigation into genocide of the country's indigenous people under former far-right president Jair Bolsonaro. Welcome everyone to World News. And now to the United States, where former Vice President Mike Pence is the latest high-ranking politician to be put into the spotlight for a discovery of documents marked as classified at his Indiana home. Pence's representative turned the classified records over to the FBI last week. Now, the rep said that a small number of records were accidentally boxed and transported to his home as he left office in 2021. It's unclear what information the documents contain, but the discovery comes in the wake of similar revelations about classified material discovered in President Joe Biden's private office and also Florida residence of former President Donald Trump. Records from each administration are supposed to be turned over to legal custody of U.S. National Archives during a presidential transition period. It is unlawful to knowingly remove or retain classified material. And now in a new book, a former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has staunchly defended Saudi Arabia in the case of the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He gloats about traveling to Riyadh just days after the internationally condemned killing in October 2018.
What really made the media madder than a vegan in a slaughterhouse was our relationship with Saudi Arabia. In some ways, I think the president was envious that I was the one who gave the middle finger to the Washington Post, the New York Times, and other bedwetters who did not have a grip on reality.
And Pompeo cast doubt on whether Khashoggi, a Washington Post columnist, was genuine journalist at all, a genuine journalist. And he claimed Khashoggi was instead an activist. He says the grotesque butchery was all too routine in West Asia. He didn't contest Saudi Arabia's responsibility. This, as U.S. intelligence has concluded, that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman personally ordered the killing. In his book, Pompeo says that bin Salman was a reformist and historic figure. He says that there should instead have been more scrutiny of the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who criticized Saudi Arabia for the killing. Brazil's federal police are investigating a, quote, genocide in the Yanomami territory. That's the country's largest indigenous reservation. Probe comes after a government report revealed nearly 100 Yanomami children died last year due to malnutrition, pneumonia, and malaria. Deaths are linked to massive gold mining activity in the region. Use of mercury by miners to separate gold from sediment has contaminated rivers and fish. Brazil's justice minister says probe will consider possible environmental crimes. Brazil's new president, Ignacio Lula da Silva, has said that his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, caused the crisis by paving the way for 20,000 illegal miners. Bolsonaro has denied responsibility, calling such accusations a left-wing farce. Peru's president has called for, quote, national truce to end weeks of unrest against a backdrop of demands for her resignation and fresh elections.
We call for a truce. We called the Congress, and now I call my dear homeland for for a national truce to establish the dialogue tables and, better still, to be able to set the agenda for each region and develop our peoples.
President Dina Boluarte says she will not back down from the path of dialogue, peace, and unity. Peruvian head of state ruled out resignation but said she has no intention to remain in power. Now, Boluarte said that weeks of deadly protests resulted in more than $1.3 billion in damage. Protests in Peru began in December after then-President Pedro Castillo was arrested and jailed and replaced by Vice President Dina Boluarte. Protesters also want Castillo released. Some 50 people have so far been killed throughout the disturbances. Brazil and Argentina are planning for greater economic integration, including the creation of a common currency. Announcement came as the Brazilian President Lula da Silva visited Argentina on his first trip abroad since taking office start of the year.
The two biggest economies in South America are starting talks to create a common currency. Brazil's President Luiz Inácio da Silva and Argentina's President Alberto Fernandez wrote in a joint piece published in Argentinian paper Perfil that they wanted to foster greater integration between the two neighbors. The pair said they had decided to move forward with discussions about a common South American currency that could be used for financial and commercial flows, reducing operating costs and other external vulnerability.
What we're trying to work on right now is to have our finance ministers, each with their economy teams and with a lot of debate and meetings, flow the foreign trade and transaction between the two countries with a common currency.
The announcement came as Lula has visited Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. At a press conference in Buenos Aires, he said establishing a common currency for trade would reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, whose sharp ascent last year was painful for countries around the world. Lula said, "If it depended on me, we would have external commerce always in the same currency of the other countries so we wouldn't have to depend on the dollar." The Financial Times had previously reported, citing Argentina's economy minister, Sergio Massa, that the neighboring nations would announce this week they were starting work on a common currency. Massa indicated that though initially a bilateral project, the initiative would be offered to other nations in Latin America, adding it's Argentina and Brazil inviting the rest of the region. Argentina and Brazil are both part of the Mercosur trade bloc, which also includes Paraguay and Uruguay. Talk of creating a common currency has periodically cropped up since its founding in 1991. Brazil is Argentina's largest trade partner. It's the top destination for Argentine exports, amounting to 14.3% and $12.7 billion in 2022. Close to 20% of Argentina's imports are from Brazil, worth just over $16 billion last year. Emerging markets have also been hit hard by the strong U.S. dollar, drawing complaints about its dominance in the global financial system. The greenback rallied nearly 8% against a basket of major currencies in 2022, making imports of food and energy more expensive.
The imposition of U.S. trade restrictions and sanctions against a number of countries, including Russia, Iran, Cuba, North Korea, Iraq, and Syria, have been ineffective and backfired against Western economies. As a result, U.S. dollar has been losing its role as a major worldwide currency in international trade transactions, and this provides a unique opportunity for regional currencies and alternative payment systems to fill the vacuum, just like what Argentina and Brazil are planning to do.
Over 24 countries have been the target of unilateral or partial trade sanctions for not adhering to the policies of the U.S. and other Western powers. These limitations, nevertheless, have turned out to be detrimental to the economies of the group of seven nations and have begun to impact the U.S. dollar's hegemony in the world. The International Monetary Fund recorded a decline in central bank holdings of U.S. dollar reserves during the fourth quarter of 2020, which went from 71% to 59%, reflecting the US dollar's waning influence on the world economy. And it continues to worsen. Evidence of this can be seen in the fact that the banking holdings of dollar claims have decreased from $7 trillion in 2021 to $6.4 trillion at the end of March 2022. According to an IMF report, the percentage of US dollars in central bank reserves has decreased by 12% since 1999, while the percentage of other currencies, particularly the Chinese yuan, have shown an increasing trend with a 9% rise during this period. For instance, to boost global commerce and Indian exports, the Reserve Bank of India devised in July last year a rupee settlement mechanism to fend off pressure on the Indian currency. India has recently concluded agreements for currency exchanges of $75.4 billion with the UAE, Japan, and various South Asian nations. New Delhi has also informed South Korea and Turkey of its non-dollar mediated exchange rates for each country's currency. Currently, Turkey conducts business utilizing the national currency of China, yuan, and Russia, ruble. Iran has also proposed to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization euro-like SCO currency for trade among the Eurasian bloc to stop the weaponization of the US dollar-dominated global financial system. Moscow and Beijing have already set up a cross-border interbank payment network similar to SWIFT, increased their gold purchases to give their currencies more stability, and signed agreements to swap national currencies in several regional and bilateral deals. The trend towards de-dollarization in international trade, particularly among the BRICS nations, has gained significant momentum in recent years. Together, they represent 41% of the world's population, 24% of its GDP, and 16% of its commerce. In 2015, the BRICS New Development Bank recommended the use of national currencies in trade. 4 years later, the bank provided 25% of its $15 billion in financial assistance in local currencies and plans to increase this to 50% in the coming years.
Now, more bad news for the British economy. New official data shows the government's debt almost tripled last month as it struggles to keep energy prices low for Britons through subsidizing gas and electricity. The Office for National Statistics says the public sector net borrowing in December hit nearly £27.5 billion, up from around £17 billion a year earlier. That was the highest monthly debt figure in two decades. Data says that Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's energy support schemes for businesses and individuals added almost £7 billion to borrowing. Interest payments also soared to over £17 billion last month, almost double compared to the previous year. Britain is grappling with a cost-of-living crisis due to record-high two-digit inflation. Energy prices have been skyrocketing since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war. Recently, the Bank of England took a series of aggressive interest rate hikes to cool inflation, but this has also ramped up the cost of state borrowing. Turkey indefinitely postpones a new round of talks with Sweden and Finland on their bid to join NATO. Talks were scheduled to take place in Brussels. Turkey's decision came a day after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan warned Sweden that he will not support the bid to join the Western Military Alliance. The Turkish government has expressed serious discontent with the burning of the Holy Quran by a far-right Swedish figure just outside the Swedish or the Turkish embassy in Stockholm last weekend. Membership in NATO must be ratified by all members of the alliance, of which Turkey is one. A Swiss parliamentary committee votes to request a change to the country's laws to allow its war material to be transferred via third countries to Ukraine. Now, Security Policy Committee decided with 14 votes in favor and 11 against to pave the way for such transfers. Committee said the government could still decide to continue barring the transfer of Swiss weaponry in cases where arms transfers pose a major risk to foreign policy. New motion needs to be approved and implemented by full parliament. Switzerland has so far refused to allow countries holding Swiss-made weaponry to export to Ukraine. This is in line with Switzerland's strict military neutrality. Under Swiss law, export requests cannot be approved if the recipient country is in an international armed conflict. EU foreign ministers rubber stamp an additional 500 million euros in military support for Ukraine. Now this as peace activists are calling on the bloc's leaders to take a different approach. Jerome Hughes has your details out of Brussels.
Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional 500 million euro military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of 49 billions is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic, and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical tensions, drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Officials of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement have emphasized that the United States and Britain are trying to continue the aggression and siege of Yemen and prevent any meaningful peace being achieved in the country. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website of Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The Foreign Ministry of Yemen's National Salvation Government has severely censured the United Kingdom over its criminal approach towards the impoverished and war-wracked Arab country, stating that its policies have led to the serious deterioration of the Yemeni people's sufferings as it torpedoes any attempt aimed at establishing a nationwide peace. The Yemeni Foreign Ministry said in a statement that London is involved in everyday hostilities being committed against the Yemeni nation and stands brazenly on the side of Saudi-backed thieves and terrorists who were deposed by the Yemeni people. It stressed that the latest remarks by British Ambassador to Yemen, Richard Oppenheim, clearly attest to London's criminal role in exacerbating the suffering of the Yemeni people and explicitly shows that Britain is chiefly accountable for the maximum pressure campaign against Yemen, the blockade of Yemen, and the starvation of the Yemeni people. The statement pointed out that the British ambassador to Sana'a, Richard Oppenheim's comments, have brought shame on all Britons and acknowledged Britain is engaged in war crimes being committed against the Yemeni people. It read, "These crimes, which are being committed without any reservations, give the Yemeni nation the full right to pursue and punish British officials through all available legal channels." The head and deputy head of Yemen's so-called Presidential Leadership Council reviewed the current situation in the country in a meeting with Richard Oppenheim in the Saudi capital Riyadh on 10th of January. The Presidential Leadership Council chairman, Rashad Al-Alami, briefed the British ambassador to Yemen on retaliatory attacks on oil facilities and what he claimed the implications of these attacks on the humanitarian and economic situation in the country. Richard Oppenheim said Britain supports the Saudi-backed government of Yemen and claimed the coordination of so-called efforts to ensure that 2023 is a year of peace for the Yemeni people. The Yemeni Foreign Ministry stressed that Britain is apparently prolonging the Yemeni war, further deteriorating the miseries of the Yemeni people, impeding peace efforts and resuming vicious military assault. It held Britain, the United States of America and their allies fully responsible for the status quo in Yemen and warned against the rise of tensions in the country. The ministry finally called on the United Nations and all freedom-loving people of the world to condemn Britain's flagrant intervention in Yemen's domestic affairs, which significantly obstructs restoration of peace in Yemen. The statement underlined the need for a balanced and thorough assessment of the economic situation in Yemen and effective measures to address the suffering of the Yemeni people. The English website of the Yemeni broadcaster Al Mayadeen television network has also covered the same story. The Sana'a government's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour said on Saturday, 21st of January, Britain cannot have a hand in alleviating the economic suffering of the Yemeni people, explaining that Britain is a main party to the aggression in Yemen. The Yemeni Prime Minister told Al Masira television channel, The United Kingdom, through the multilateral agreement, will not give a single pound to ensure the success of the former mercenary regime's proposals, adding, "It is going through an economic crisis and looking towards others for help." He said, "The United Kingdom is still this day a main party to the aggression in Yemen in terms of planning and execution. London is the protector of the former regime of mercenaries." Prime Minister Abdulaziz Ben Habtour underlined, "The British ambassador's recent statements are irresponsible. The former mercenary regime's decision to raise the price of the customs dollar rate is directed, in this circumstance, against the entire Yemeni people." It is noteworthy that Britain supported the measure in question, which was met with condemnation from Yemen as an extension of the blockade imposed on the country by the West and by the Saudi-led coalition of aggression. The British ambassador to Sana'a said the United Kingdom supports the economic measure implemented by the former mercenary regime, holding the Ansar Allah movement responsible for the humanitarian situation in the country. This claim comes as the United States and Britain have been imposing a stifling air, land, and sea blockade on Yemen. The Prime Minister of Yemen said the British ambassador's statements publicly revealed the criminal role played by London in exacerbating the suffering of the Yemeni people. Prime Minister Abdulaziz Ben Habtour added, "The statements in question prove that London stands behind the economic warfare, including the policies of blockade and starvation." The Associated Press has also covered the same story. A new report said recently weapons supplied by the United Kingdom and the United States to the Saudi-led coalition in war-torn Yemen killed at least 839 civilians and wounded 1,775 others in just over a year. The report by the charity Oxfam revealed that the Saudi-led coalition used weapons supplied solely by Britain and the United States in hundreds of attacks targeting innocent civilians in Yemen between January of 2021 and the end of February 2022. The 43-page Oxfam report, authored by Martin Butcher, Oxfam's policy advisor on arms and conflict, stated that an analysis of attacks showed that the Saudi-led forces used Western-supplied weapons in hundreds of relentless attacks against civilian targets in Yemen during this 14-month period. According to the report, of all the attacks by the Saudi-led coalition during the 14-month period from January of 2021 through to February of 2022, airstrikes alone killed at least 87 civilians and wounded 136 others. The coalition attacks, 19 of which targeted medical institutions and ambulances, during this period included airstrikes by jet fighters as well as artillery attacks, missile attacks and drone attacks, in addition to casualties from landmines, road bombs and light arms. Martin Butcher, Oxfam's policy advisor on arms and conflict, said, "It's just so relentless. People just find it so hard to escape the violence and the killing in Yemen." The report also found that in the attacks, the coalition used Western-made cluster munitions, weapons banned by international convention and customary law. Martin Butcher called on Western governments, particularly the United States of America and Britain, to immediately cease arms sales to Saudi Arabia for use in Yemen and to promote a permanent ceasefire and negotiations for a long-term settlement through its position as a member of the United Nations Security Council. Martin Butcher said, "The government's really been not only arming Saudi Arabia, but also very reluctant to use their position in the UN Security Council to push for peace in Yemen. The United States of America and Britain are the main suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia, selling tens of billions of dollars worth of arms to Riyadh. For decades, Saudi authorities have been the lead importers of American-made and British-manufactured weapons. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support, from the United States and Britain and various other Western countries has launched a devastating war in Yemen in March of 2015. The objective of the war was to crush the Ansar Allah movement, which has been running the country in the absence of a functioning government, and to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly, unpopular regime of Abdul Rabo Mansour Hadi.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. And in this program, we try to answer your questions, queries, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqavi, who's a faculty member at Al Mustafa University, Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. It's an honor.
We have one more audience question. What is the way to behave with a young boy who is misbehaving with his parents and gets upset very soon, be that at school or at home?
The child that we were talking about is maybe he becomes irritated. He does not have the patience to deal with his feelings or others' behavior. The problem, we have to find the cause of it, the root cause of it. Where does it start from? Maybe he is living in a family who have very high expectations from him. They continuously scold him. They continuously make him do things which makes him things which make him cross the limits, and he is not capable of that. He becomes irritated. He feels that he cannot cope up with things. He has to go to the extremes to do it. He has children. The parents are not respecting him. They're not understanding him. They're not able to communicate with him. So he cannot express his feelings in a very simple way, in a convenient way. He feels suppressed. His feelings are suppressed. So in that sense, of course, he becomes irritated, and there are outbursts of anger when he cannot bear the behavior which is being meted out to him. He expresses his irritation or his anger in a manner which is not respectful for elders. So maybe the cause are the elders themselves. Or where, for example, he goes to a school where the teacher's behavior is not according to what it should be. A teacher is not just a teacher who is teaching him and imparting him information. Teacher is a guide, is a mentor, is a coach. So if he unfortunately does not find the teachers in such a way, they're not ready to listen to him, they're not ready to engage with him, they're not ready to give him time and respect his feelings, so he feels irritated. Now we need to change our behavior and to make him realize that we are open for him, we are there for him, he can express his views, express his ideas, he can express his feelings without feeling bad about it. And that is one issue. Another issue is that, for example, when the behavior becomes so entrenched in his habits that it's difficult to remove it just by talking to him or engaging with him, there we need to deal with it with him in a firm way. Then again, a firm way does not mean to start to become angry as a reaction to his outbursts.
Okay.
It needs to be our way of behaving and telling him off should be also controlled. Sometimes he becomes happy, maybe. Sometimes he becomes disturbed and upset. But we should maintain a balance. We should, in such a way that we need to make him realize that you're making a mistake. Even if he shows off, expresses joy, expresses things, there we should maintain a sort of decorum in which he feels that today he's being good, but the other day he was bad.
Okay, so we have to have that balance in our
behavior.
We need
to balance that and to make him realize that his habitual behavior, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, is mostly bad, then you have to also behave in such a, you have to behave with him in such a way, you have to behave with him in such a way that he realizes his mistake.
Yeah. So Professor, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakavi. We're discussing about an adolescent who feels irritated very soon and often misbehaves with his parents. Professor, there's a African proverb which says the child who is not embraced by the village will burn it down to feel its warmth. So you said that a child is looking for something, and when he does not see that happening in the school, in the behavior of his parents, he gets irritated. So what has to be changed is the behavior around him.
Exactly. So basically, all human beings, as I said, need love and care, respect. They need dignity. So if someone, I mean, the basic concept that Islam gives and the Quran says is Karramna bani Adam. Allah Almighty has created human beings and given them dignity. This dignity has to be maintained. So dignity of ourselves and dignity of others. Both are in question. And that comes through love and respect. We should have a dignified and balanced behavior ourselves, and we should, by providing a role model to others, make our children realize that they have to maintain their dignity. They need to be respected. They need to be loved. Now, most of the times, when in societies which are not educated, they are not they have not been brought up in a good manner. All these things they're not there in society. The love, respect, how to talk to each other, how to be how to be able to communicate properly in a tone which is good, which is dignified, which mm-hmm. is which attracts other people, which makes them feel good, or even more important than talking is listening, to be good listeners.
Okay, sometimes you have to be a good listener.
One of the aspects of a good communicator, a good leader, is being a good listener.
Okay.
And the Holy Prophet is mentioned in the Quran to be a good listener.
Okay, he's mentioned as a good listener in the Quran.
Well, أُذُنُ خَيْرٍ لَكُمْ. He's a good listener for you. He listens to you. Whatever you, people come to him, they talk about it, their problems, their issues, and he patiently listens to them. So one of the things which we as parents
need... So here Prophet is being explained as an exemplar of a good listener.
Of a good listener. And today, when we talk about leadership and we talk about management, one of the...
Skills is
being able to listen.
Yeah. We'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Prophet Seneca V. And we're discussing about an adolescent boy who misbehaved with his parents and gets upset very soon at school or at home. Professor Nakavi, you said that it is basically the environment around that has to be changed, the behavior around, be that at school or be it parents. So what else can parents do? You said that sometimes you have to be a good listener. So one thing is clear, we don't have to fix all things in the adolescent boy himself. We have to fix things, something in ourselves. One of them is to be a good listener.
One aspect of being a good communicator is to be a good listener. So if we can't impose things upon our children, especially when they have reached an age where they can start thinking of their own and they become independent, and they feel that they're independent, and they feel that they know better than their parents. So you can't expect them to accept everything you say. You can't expect them to, impose your will and your whatever you say. You need to be able to communicate your point of view. The child should be able to communicate what he has in mind. Then there's a positive debate about that issue. There's a positive issue, way of dealing with it. Unfortunately, nowadays, the children encounter so many things, especially in the virtual world, they think they know more than their children, their parents. And actually, that might be true. The information which children today receive is much more than their parents used to receive and understand. The information is monumental. It's different. It's so vast. And they may feel that their parents don't know. So one thing which is important is that parents need to keep themselves updated about many things which are happening today. They control the information volume for their children. And if they can't do that, then they need to remain abreast with the developments which are taking place so they can engage with their children. If they can't do it themselves, then they need to find a person who can
help them
and become a mentor for them and for their children and discuss with them and debate with them. There are so many people out there today,
who
so
can
many
act
children,
as counselors.
They can act as counselors. And there are so many questions today about the very basics of Islam. the very basics of the fundamentals of Islam. Today, unfortunately, because of this materialistic mindset that we all have, and as we mentioned before, the information technology, the explosion of information, the expansion of the human knowledge base about the universe, and the absence of God in those in that information, the
plane,
where does God, Allah Almighty, come in? No one explains that. So with the vast amount of information coming from all over the world, people, children are today, they really know things which we do not know about. So we need to know about those things, and we need to be able to analyze those things, and we need to be able to make them understand that we know more than them, or at least we have more experience. We can analyze things much better than them, and then we can achieve results which are logical more than they can, because they, unfortunately, are their thoughts may be subdued, or maybe they may be under the influence of their feelings.
Yeah. So when a adolescent boy is upset with the environment around, or he is irritated or misbehaving, we got to see something is happening against his will, and we got to change the behaviors around. Rather than fixing the child himself, we have to fix things, many things ourselves, and we have to educate ourselves in many, many issues, seek help from the counselors around. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
In the limelight.
The FBI has found more classified documents at the Wilmington, Delaware home of President Joe Biden. We'll take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Associated Press has covered this story and tells us more. The FBI searched President Joe Biden's home in Wilmington, Delaware on Friday, 20th of January, and located six additional documents containing classification markings, and also took possession of some of his notes, the president's lawyer said on Saturday. Bob Bauer, the president's personal lawyer, said the search of the entire premises lasted nearly 13 hours. The documents with classification markings spanned Joe Biden's time in the Senate and in the vice presidency, while the notes dated to his time as vice president. The search followed more than a week after Biden's attorneys found six other classified documents in the president's home library from his time as vice president, and nearly 3 months after lawyers found a small number of classified records at his former offices at the Penn Biden Center in Washington. On Thursday, 19th of January, President Biden maintained that there's no there on the document discoveries, which have become a political headache for the president and complicated the Justice Department's probe into former President Donald Trump's retention of classified documents and official records after he left office. We found a handful of documents were filed in the wrong place, Biden told reporters who questioned him during a tour of the damage from storms in California. We immediately turned them over to the archives and the Justice Department. Biden said he was fully cooperating and looking forward to getting this resolved quickly. The president and First Lady Jill Biden were not at home when it was searched. They were spending the weekend at their home in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. President's personal lawyer, Bob Bauer, said the FBI requested that the White House not comment on the search before it was conducted, and that Biden's personal and White House attorneys were present. The FBI, he added, had full access to the president's home, including personally handwritten notes, files, papers, binders, memorabilia, to-do lists, schedules, and reminders going back decades. The Justice Department, he added, took possession of materials it deemed within the scope of its inquiry, including six items consisting of documents with classification markings and surrounding materials, some of which were from the president's service in the Senate and some of which were from his tenure as vice president. Attorney General Merrick Garland has appointed former Maryland U.S. Attorney Robert Herr as a special counsel to investigate any potential wrongdoing surrounding the Biden documents. Since the beginning, the president has been committed to handling this responsibly because he takes this seriously, White House lawyer Richard Sober said on Saturday. Sober added, the president's lawyers and White House counsel's office will continue to cooperate with the Department of Justice and the special counsel to help ensure this process is conducted swiftly and efficiently. The Biden document discoveries and the investigation into Donald Trump, which is in the hands of the special counsel Jack Smith, are significantly different. The Justice Department says Donald Trump took hundreds of records marked classified with him upon leaving the White House in early 2021 and resisted months of requests to return them to the government. President Biden has made a point of cooperating with the Department of Justice probe at every turn, though questions about his transparency with the public remain. The website of CNBC has also covered this story and tells us more. The FBI found more classified documents at the Wilmington, Delaware home of President Joe Biden during a consensual search on Friday, 20th of January, that lasted nearly 13 hours, his personal lawyer and a prosecutor said on Saturday evening. The discovery was the fourth time since November that classified records or material has been found at a private address of Joe Biden's. His personal lawyer, Bob Bauer, in a statement said the Department of Justice seized six items consisting of documents with classification markings and surrounding material. Joseph Fitzpatrick, Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, told NBC News, I can confirm that the FBI on Friday executed a planned consensual search of the president's residence in Wilmington, Delaware. Some of the items dated from Joe Biden's tenure in the Senate, where he represented Delaware from 1973 through to 2009, Bob Bauer said, and some of the items were from his tenure as vice president in the Obama administration, from 2009 through to 2017. In addition to those records, FBI agents who did not have a warrant for the search also seized some notes that Biden wrote by hand as vice president, according to a lawyer and the White House. Neither Joe Biden nor First Lady Jill Biden were present during the search, according to Richard Sober, special counsel to the president. The items join an undisclosed number of classified government records previously discovered by lawyers for the president. A small number of classified records first were found by Biden's lawyers on 2nd of November at a private office that he kept at a Washington, D.C. think tank after ending his tenure as vice president in the Obama administration in 2017. The White House only disclosed that discovery on 9th of January. On 20th of December, a small number of classified records were found in the garage of Joe Biden's Wilmington home. A single page of classified material was then found at the Wilmington residence on 11th of January. Then the next day, five more pages of classified records were found in a room adjacent to Joe Biden's garage. When the Department of Justice officials traveled there to take possession of the single page found the previous day. The White House has said that when the president's lawyers found the previous documents, they immediately notified the National Archives and Records Administration and the Department of Justice. Friday's search was the first time revealed publicly that federal law enforcement authorities have conducted a search for government documents at Joe Biden's private addresses. Attorney General Merrick Garland earlier this month appointed a special counsel to investigate Joe Biden's retention of government records after he was vice president. Former President Donald Trump is under criminal investigation by another special counsel for taking hundreds of classified records and other government documents from the White House when he left office. Donald Trump is also being eyed for possible obstruction of justice by stonewalling efforts by government officials to recover those documents. The FBI in early August raided Donald Trump's home at his Mar-a-Lago club in Palm Beach, Florida, where they found thousands of pages of government records. The FBI had a search warrant in that case. By law, presidents and vice presidents must return government documents to the National Archives when they leave office. Joe Biden and the White House have been criticized for the two-month lag in disclosing the discovery of the first batch of classified documents at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement in Washington, D.C.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.